Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
And welcome to another episode of Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker Trent Horn. And on Fridays, we take a break from theology and apologetics, or at least direct, explicit defense and explanation of the faith, to talk about whatever I think is interesting and I think you will think is interesting as well. Interesting tidbit, I was looking at the download statistics for the podcast, and last week's Free for All Friday, it's titled Putting the Fun into Fundraising, did not get listened to a lot, and I'm worried that some people looked at the title and thought I was just going to spend 20 minutes pitching why people should support the podcast. That's not what that episode was about. Last week, when I was at Midway International Airport waiting for my flight to Indianapolis to go and speak there, I decided to share my background of being a missionary. And many missionaries have to raise their own financial support. I thought I would share how I did that and give you some tips if you want to be a missionary, you know someone who is interested in doing that, or let's say you want to raise support for your parish, your school, wherever, whatever you may be doing. I thought some of those tips may be helpful. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to it, do check out last week's Free for All Friday, Putting the Fun into Fundraising. I think it will be a fun episode for you to listen to. By the way, speaking of those who are patrons at trenthornpodcast.com, you get access to bonus content, and you also get to vote in polls that are helpful to me. For example, I did a poll recently on the dialogues, and we're going to be having more dialogues soon. I've got people lined up. A lot of interesting characters, by the way. I've got a pastor who is pro-LGBT. Hopefully, we'll have him on at the end of August. Dialogue possibly with someone who is Eastern Orthodox on the nature of God. I've got a Satanist waiting in the wings, and I think we're going to move that one closer to Halloween, Catholicism versus Satanism. So we've got a lot of things down the pike. And so what I wanted to do, I always want your guys' feedback because you know what you'd like from the podcast, and I'm willing to listen and learn and grow to make this a resource that will help build you up in your faith. So the poll that we did at trenthornpodcast.com was on the question of the dialogues. We've had a few. We had Steve Farrell on about abortion, Tom Rafferty about atheism. Randall Rouser did four of them with me. And I want to do more of those. But I asked, what length do you want them to be? 30 minutes, 60 minutes, 90 minutes? Because my concern is, well, if you know, I don't want them to be too long because people are used to 30-minute episodes. But if they're too short, you know, we get the dialogue going and then it just abruptly stops, you know, right when we're getting into our groove. So I think after looking at the votes, and it seems that the majority of people want those dialogue episodes to be around an hour long, I think. And they could be even longer if it's going really well. So I think what I'm going to do is this: for future dialogues, I'm going to invite people on and we're going to have the dialogue. It's going to go as long as I think it's fruitful and worth listening to. I mean, I highly doubt I'm going to go longer than 90 minutes, for example, because some of these things, you know, you could talk forever. But, you know, there is actually old, it's not a debate, it's more of a dialogue. You've got to listen to these audio recordings. Maybe in a future episode, I'll share them with you. It's one of the first, like, publicly broadcasted via radio debates on the existence of God. And it's between Bertrand Russell, not enough evidence to believe in God, not enough evidence. And our resident British superfan will no doubt comment that once again, I have botched an English accent, although I'm hoping to have him on the podcast next week to show you how you don't know Jack, aka you don't know C.S. Lewis. So that's going to be a fun treat next week here on the podcast. It was between Bertrand Russell, the famous atheist, author of Why I'm Not a Christian, and Frederick Copleston, who's Catholic, a Catholic philosopher. I can't remember if he was a priest or not. I think he was a priest, who wrote a 9-volume series on philosophy. And their dialogue between Copleston and Russell, it goes on, I think, for like 12 hours or something like that. It's obscenely long. I'm not going to do that here on the podcast. So let's say I do hour-long dialogues here on out. I'll probably divide them up and do back-to-back episodes. And hearing from my wife, I think some of those weeks, instead of a Tuesday and Thursday episode, you might get two back-to-back episodes on Tuesday so as not to leave you in suspense. But I think it's also nice to break them up in half-hour bites because some people order their day around, I know I've got my half-hour podcast that I can listen to. And so I definitely want to provide that with you all. So that is news and update coming down the pike. The reason we haven't had a dialogue recently is because I'm so close. Pray for me and Catherine Bacolic. We're almost done with the manuscript for Why Catholics Can't Be Socialists. I already published my response to Dean Detloff on the question of, you know, can Catholics be communists? I'd love to have him actually on the podcast to talk about that. So we'll see if we can get that to pan out. So that's why, you know, like when I have a project, it's just right in front of me and I can't see anything else around it. Especially when you write a book, the last part of the book is just so all-consuming. I finished that as well as my new course, Moral Apologetics, which is going to be offered through the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics. Lots of great stuff coming at you. If you want to be at the tip of the iceberg, at the head of the train, do check out trendhornpodcast.com. And if you're a subscriber, you get the first grab at all that new stuff coming at you from Catholic Answers and from the Council of Trent podcast. Now, on to the subject of today's podcast. I was reading an article on CNN.com. I think it was published June 30th. I've been meaning to talk about this for a while. It's a news article about a new nuclear reactor in Russia. So the headline is, Russia plans to tow a nuclear power station to the Arctic. Critics dub it a floating Chernobyl. And so that's obviously a reference to the, I think it was 1986 disaster in the Soviet Union. The reactor number 4 at Chernobyl nuclear power plant melts down, explodes, spreads nuclear radiation around the Chernobyl site, the city, including Pripyat, Ukraine. And some of that material even got further around the globe. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But people have been talking a lot about nuclear power recently, especially with the Chernobyl series on HBO, which I hear is amazing, actually. I'm hoping to borrow somebody's HBO password or, you know, something to be able to go on and check it out for myself or find any licit means. I'm not going to steal from HBO, but if there is a licit means for someone to share with me the series, I would enjoy finding that to watch it. Because you know me, the very first Free for All Fridays we did here on the podcast were devoted to disasters and things going wrong. And when many people think of disasters, nuclear disasters give them a kind of sense of dread and fear. And so that's why I think this story is kind of bogged down with that. And I hate the idea critics call it a floating Chernobyl. Well, who are these critics? Oh, I'm going to get to that in a second. So here's what the article says. Next month, so now, as you're listening to this, a floating nuclear power plant called the Akademik Lomonosov will be towed via the Northern Sea Route to its final destination in the Far East after almost two decades in construction. It's part of Russia's ambition to bring electric power to a mineral-rich region. The 472-foot-long platform, painted in the colors of the Russian flag, is going to float next to a small Arctic port town of Pevek, some 4,000 miles away from Moscow. Will supply electricity to settlements and companies extracting hydrocarbons and precious stones in the Chukotka region. They've created essentially a nuclear power plant for Siberia instead of building one on tundra. I mean, building anything in Siberia, there's a great show on Netflix, World's Most Dangerous Roads. And the scariest one to me is the road that goes through Siberia. Well, they call it the Road of Bones because it was built by prisoners of the Soviet gulag who died trying to construct it in places where it's negative 60 degrees Fahrenheit, which goes to show you what you get from communism, which is why Catholics can't be socialists. Check out my book, Spring 2020. So instead of building a nuclear power plant in the middle of Siberia, they're just going to float one there. They've built an operating nuclear power plant on a ship, which is not that unusual because we have nuclear submarines and aircraft carriers in, you know, many militaries and navies that work that are powered by small nuclear reactors. I mean, the energy you can get from nuclear power is amazing in its efficiency. And of course, that's the subject of today, is why I love nuclear power. We need more of it. Why don't we? Especially when people are saying we've got climate change problems, we need to do something about clean energy. We've got a great solution here, and yet people get the heebie-jeebies about it. And I don't quite understand why when you do a little bit of digging. So they want to put this plant out there to provide this clean energy here in Siberia. And to talk about the efficiency, 1 kilogram, so about 2.2 pounds of uranium, can supply as much electricity as, so 1 kilogram of uranium can supply as much electricity as I think something like 3 million kilograms of coal. And coal is dirty and disgusting when you burn it. It's very unhealthy for the environment, the people who are breathing it in. It's dangerous to mine. we've got a way better solution here, and yet there's always the critics. So it goes on to say that I think the does it mention here the critics are, oh, here it is. But the concept of a nuclear reactor stationed in the Arctic Sea has drawn criticism from environmentalists. The Lomonosov platform was dubbed Chernobyl on ice, or floating Chernobyl, by Greenpeace. Even before the public's revived interest in the 1986 catastrophe, thanks in large part to the HBO TV series of the same name. Greenpeace is just the worst. I mean, they began as an environmental movement that was dedicated towards doing noble goals, like cleaning up the environment, making sure that we're not causing irreparable damage to the ecosystem that could harm human beings. But eventually, Greenpeace drifted away from its noble roots, or at least somewhat more noble roots, into being where many environmentalists fall short. This is something that Pope Francis criticizes in Laudato Si. So Laudato Si is Pope Francis's encyclical on the environment. It's addressed to all people of goodwill. And it's not, it mentions climate change briefly, but it's more about the environment and our collective home that we're called to care for. And he does criticize in there people who claim that in order to protect the environment, we have to value the environment more than human beings. And so there's a lot of environmentalists that have embraced this kind of deep ecology. This is a movement that says that in order to protect the earth from human beings have to be minimized, or we have to get rid of human beings. Sometimes the fringe people talk about violence getting rid of human beings, but others will just say we need to use abortion and contraception to dramatically lower the birth rate until we can all voluntarily go out of extinction. So there's a wonderful video actually on Prager University by Patrick Moore. Patrick Moore was one of the creators of Greenpeace, and he was an environmentalist in the 1960s and 1970s. He later left that movement because it drifted so far from his original intentions. I'm going to play a clip from Patrick Moore, one of the founders of Greenpeace, explaining why he left, because they've drifted from a pro-environmental mission to being one that's anti-human, essentially. So here's what he says.
I had noticed something else. As we grew into an international organization, with over 100 million a year coming in, a big change in attitude had occurred. The peace in Greenpeace had faded away. Only the green part seemed to matter now. Humans, to use Greenpeace language, had become the enemies of the Earth. Putting an end to industrial growth and banning many useful technologies and chemicals became common themes of the movement. Science and logic no longer held sway. Sensationalism, misinformation, and fear were what we used to promote our campaigns.
So then he goes on to talk about some of them. I think one that he gives an example of is the use of chlorine as a water purifier and used for public health remedies. How Greenpeace vilified it, even though they didn't have evidence to support that claim. So that was, let's see, I think I can find it. Let's see, I'll put it right here.
Wealthy individuals and countries always find a way around these follies. The ones who suffer are those in developing countries, people we're presumably trying to help. For example, Greenpeace has opposed the adoption of golden rice, a genetically modified variety of rice that contains beta carotene. Golden rice has the potential to prevent the death of 2 million of the world's poorest children every year. But that doesn't matter to the Greenpeace crowd. GMOs are bad, so golden rice must be bad. Apparently millions of children dying isn't.
Okay, so I couldn't find the clip about chlorine, but that's just as bad to oppose genetically modified foods that do not present a risk to us, that more so not adopting these things present a risk. And the same is true of nuclear power. Greenpeace has been opposed to using nuclear power for decades and has used misinformation and scare tactics. So many people, when they hear nuclear power, the first thing that they think of is Chernobyl, maybe Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan, which actually there were no deaths related to that. Fukushima was the nuclear power plant in Japan during the 2011 Japanese tsunami that experienced a reactor failure because of the tsunami. It overwhelmed their pumps, so they weren't able to cool the reactors. However, the resulting nuclear incident did not kill anyone. The people who died were those who were hastily evacuated. More people were killed in the evacuation process than in the actual nuclear incident itself. And so when people think of nuclear power, they think of nuclear accidents, they think of nuclear waste, or a few people think of, you know, we don't want more nuclear power plants because people are going to use the fuel to create nuclear weapons. So that's why in this podcast, I want to talk about the realities of nuclear power and why this is actually a great idea and would help with many of the climate change problems that we're dealing with right now. One of the things I think that we have to, even whether or not you agree with climate change or not, I think you could agree at the very least we should use clean energy that doesn't pollute, or at least its pollution is extremely minimal and containable, that can create dependable power, especially in very poor developing parts of the world that need clean, reliable, cheap energy. And that's something that nuclear can do. We have to get over the misinformation campaigns. That's why the title of this episode is actually Atomic Power to the Rescue. Because honestly, I think one way you could get people, words are a funny thing. One way you could get people on board with this is just stop saying nuclear and just say atomic. That throws you back to the good old 1950s. I imagine I'm sitting in class with my crew cut hair and my khakis, you know, the projector reels are going, and I'm hearing some guy say, "Atomic power is the wave of the future, Johnny." So, you know, I like, you know, you hear atomic power, you're like, ooh, atoms, science. That's a great thing. Nuclear just has, you know, too many of these negative connotations to it. So that's my humble suggestion, is that if you want to get people on board with nuclear power, just call it atomic power. I think that actually has a better ring to it for people. So, all right, let's get down to this to show why this is a good idea. First, how does nuclear power work? You ask people how we get power. Many people can vaguely describe it to you. And I'm not a nuclear engineer by any means. So this is just an excerpt from energy.gov, from the government's energy website, explaining it. The main job of a nuclear reactor is to house and control nuclear fission, a process where atoms split and release energy. Reactors use uranium for nuclear fuel. The uranium is processed into small ceramic pellets and stacked together into sealed metal tubes called fuel rods. Typically, more than 200 of these rods are bundled together to form a fuel assembly. A reactor core is typically made up of a couple hundred assemblies, depending on power level. So before I go on, the goal here, how do you make power? The way you make power, basically, is to find a way, any kind of energy, you're converting one kind of energy into another kind of energy. Energy just doesn't come from free. You have to convert one kind of energy into another kind of energy to make it useful. And the way to get electricity is to typically spin a dynamo. You spin a series of magnets around a coil. I mean, in reactors and power plants, I'm sure it's different, but that's the basic principle. How do you get that? You need to take that mechanical energy of spinning the coil, the magnets around the dynamo. You need mechanical energy of turning the turbines, which creates electrical energy. But how do you get that mechanical energy? You've got to be able to turn the turbine somehow. So there's different ways you could do that. You could use water, for example. Water, will push the turbines. That's how you get hydroelectric power, like dams, like the Hoover Dam, for example. You could create combustion. You could burn something. And so if you burn it, it creates heat and it turns things. Just like your car, if your car uses gasoline, what it does is, you know, fuel vapor goes into the engine and it creates essentially a small explosion. That small explosion pushes a piston down, and that piston is what turns the axles and moves the car forward. So you could burn fuel, you could push with water, you could use tidal energy. The tides go in and out. You can spin turbines that way. You can get the energy that comes from the sun. You take solar energy and can convert it with a photovoltaic cell in order to create energy from there. There, you're not having to spin a turbine. You're just converting the natural energy that exists in solar radiation. Or if you want to heat something up, you know, you want to create steam. Let's say you're just making heat. You've got uranium. Uranium has a natural steady decaying process. And so you can use that to generate a lot of heat with just a little bit of material. So a little bit of uranium, you can create heat that generates steam, and so that spins the turbine. So some people, you'll look at pictures of nuclear power plants with these white columns going out of the smokestacks, and people will think, oh no, we're polluting the environment. Well, no, that's just water vapor. You're okay. That's basically creating little clouds. That's all it's made. So when other sources are burned, when you burn things like coal and gas, you create greenhouse gases. With nuclear energy, there are two waste products. You create water vapor, which is harmless, and you create nuclear waste. You have spent uranium fuel rods that are not capable of working in a reactor, but still emit radiation, so they're dangerous for humans. So I'll talk about that here a little bit later. Now, the energy.gov article goes on to say, inside the reactor vessel, the fuel rods are immersed in water, which acts as both a coolant and moderator. The moderator helps slow down the neutrons produced by fission to sustain the chain reaction. So most reactors, in order to keep it from overheating and causing a big problem, is they use water cooling systems. And another thing that they use in order to maintain the heat and the energy reactions in the reactor is to insert these things called control rods. So a control rod is able to absorb the neutrons, these tiny particles that are emitted. It absorbs the neutrons. Control rods usually made of like boron, cadmium, silver, they can absorb neutrons without starting a fission process, without creating nuclear energy. By inserting them, it acts as kind of a dampener to slow the chain reaction. So that is, nuclear energy in a nutshell. And as I said, there's usually three problems that people associate with it. Nuclear meltdown, nuclear waste, and nuclear weapons. But these are all three overblown concerns that we shouldn't worry about. Honestly, I think a lot of people are worried about nuclear power, because the thing, if you think of like nuclear power, and the first thing I think for many people from pop culture that comes to their mind is The Simpsons, is Homer Simpson working at the nuclear plant, and you worry there's some dummy working at the nuclear plant and everything is just going to go terribly wrong. Now, there is some comedy here, which of course I have to share with you because you know me, I don't mind mixing science with popular culture. And one of my favorite episodes of The Simpsons is from season 3, Homer Defined, where Homer, by pure luck, stops a nuclear meltdown. So he presses just the wrong, he presses what he thinks is the right button. He goes, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. And he stops and he's hailed as a hero. And then he later has to try to do it again in front of the plant's operating managers, and he embarrasses himself. But I love the beginning of the episode when there's a crisis, because I think people associate nuclear power with Mr. Burns, who's a villain on The Simpsons. But I love this line from the beginning when people are at home watching the news coverage of the meltdown and Mr. Burns is interviewed. So let me play that.
Mr. Burns, people are calling this a meltdown.
Oh, meltdown. It's one of those annoying buzzwords. We prefer to call it an unrequested fission surplus.
Homie, please be all right.
Meltdown, we prefer to call it an unrequested fission surplus. And so then it goes, I'll play the end. You see where Homer manages to get through the problem by sheer luck.
Core meltdown.
Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Catch a tiger by the toe. If he hollers, let him go. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
Crisis has been averted. Everything is super.
Thank you, Homer, for saving my plant. With that idiotic rhyming, do you even know what button you push?
Sure, mo.
That's my favorite line. Do you even know what button you pushed? Sure, Mo. But the problem is that there have been real accidents. But when you look at the numbers overall, nuclear power is the safest form of power imaginable. The most famous one we can think of is Chernobyl. So the accident that happened in the Soviet Union back in on April 26, 1986. This is from the Nuclear Energy Institute. Accident occurred at Reactor 4. It resulted when operators took action in violation of the plant's procedures. Operators ran the plant at very low power without adequate safety precautions and without properly coordinating or communicating the procedure with safety personnel. So they were running a safety procedure in the middle of the night, but this wasn't communicated well with the staff on hand. And this led to the problem of power levels dropping too much that prevented the power. This is the plant's cooling systems relied on their own nuclear reactors to supply the power. So if the power level drops too low in your reactor, you don't have enough power for the cooling systems to put water in. This created a kind of feedback loop where in order to increase power, the temperature in the reactor increased too much. And there was also a problem with the reactor design itself. Chernobyl, it's not like every nuclear plant has the same reactor. Chernobyl had a very unique nuclear reactor that nobody has seen since. It was only manufactured to be used inside the Soviet Union. Nobody else used these things because they're so dangerous. It was a Soviet reactor Bolshomashnasty colony. Now my Russian listeners are going to tell I butchered Russian along with British accents, you know, Russian language and British accents. It's a Soviet RBMK design, and it's incredibly unstable. It's not used anywhere else, and it hasn't been used since. So when people tell me we shouldn't have nuclear power because of Chernobyl, I say, fine, then we shouldn't have cruise ships because of the Titanic. There are going to be problems and things that we learn, but all energy that's used has problems that are related to it. When you look at the numbers, I love the website ourworldindata.org. It's got a great synthesis of data about human life expectancy, mortality rates, about things related to human well-being. And they have an article called "What is the Safest Form of Energy?" And there's a great graph there that talks about the number of deaths associated with each kind of energy production. So they show, hypothetically, in 2014, how many deaths there would be if the entire world used one kind of energy. So the kinds of energy they have are brown coal, coal, oil, biomass, it's like burning methane and stuff like that, gas, natural gas, and nuclear. All right. So the most dangerous ones on here are coal. If we just use the dirtiest coal out there, brown coal, which is the kind that's burned in developing, in some developing countries, for power, they burn biomass, they burn dung, or they burn wood, or really, really cheap coal. If the whole world used coal, 5 million people a year would die from it. They would mostly die from respiratory ailments and illnesses associated with breathing in coal dust. Everyone would have black lung. Oil also creates pollutants that come out, and that would be, if we only used oil, it'd be 3 million people a year, along with the accidents that come with pipelines and things like that. Biomass and gas are several hundred thousand. If the entire world, though, used nuclear power, keep in mind that Sweden gets 40% of their energy from nuclear. France gets 70% of their energy from nuclear power plants. When's the last time you heard about a disaster at a French nuclear power plant? You don't. It runs great. They have a pleasant countryside, wonderful cheese and wine. You have to go to the Ile de Saint-Loup and enjoy Bertolli's ice cream. It's a beautiful place. And actually, I found the French to be quite polite. Contrary to reputations that precede them. When I was in Europe, actually, it was the Italians who were rude to me, frankly. The number of people, if the whole world ran with nuclear, you'd have about 12,000 deaths a year. That's compared to 5.2 million with the dirtiest kind, with coal. Yeah, but what about windmills and solar panels? Here's the problem. They're not reliable enough. I love solar panels. We have solar panels on our home. But the problem is that battery technology is not sophisticated enough to provide enough energy with windmill and solar power. Because here's the thing. I live in California. We get charged higher rates from 4 to 9 p.m. because that's when more people, you're home from work, you run the AC, you're doing the laundry. And the problem is, a lot of times during the year, during half the year, the sun isn't shining during those hours. Even during summer, you lose most of your sunlight by 7 p.m., so you have a problem where you have a high energy demand from 4 to 9 p.m. and during the night, but the sun's not shining. So what do? Now, you could store solar energy in batteries, but even the most efficient batteries, you put the energy electricity into a battery, like a solar battery, and you try to get it back, you're going to lose 20 to 40% of the energy in the process. It's not efficient enough. I'm fine coming up with new, efficient solar technologies and windmills. They will never be enough to meet the needs of a growing world population, including in very developing countries. There's also places where those technologies don't work well. If you live in a very cloudy place, then solar is not great for you. If you don't get a lot of perpetual wind, then windmills aren't going to work very well. Also, environmentalists get mad at windmills all the time because they're always cutting birds in half. Solar farms kill birds. The poor little birds fly over the solar farms and they get turned into Kentucky Fried Chicken. They literally cook as they fly over the solar farms and then crash. So there's always trade-offs here, but nuclear has some of the lowest trade-offs. And so that is something that I think that we should take into account. So I think that from when it comes from an accident perspective and from deaths related to its operation, nuclear is the safest form of power. But what do you do about nuclear waste? What do you do, about the spent fuel rods? The thing here is there's not that much of it. I was watching a wonderful talk, a TED talk by Michael Schellenberger, and I'll play a little clip of it here in a second. And he was once opposed to nuclear power and changed his mind. He's an environmentalist, but he says, look, this is our only hope to stop climate change and reduce our dependency on fossil fuels. We have to use nuclear. There's no other option. He changed his mind on it and has given several TED Talks on this subject. And he says the amount of nuclear waste we have, we're looking for long-term storage for sure, but there's not a lot of it. The entire nuclear waste stockpile of the United States, you could put it on a football field and it would stack about 20 feet high. That's not an undoable thing to manage. A lot of nuclear waste is kept and it's monitored in containment storage at nuclear plants. It's actually very safe. We're more likely to have accidents with pipelines or trains that carry oil through the country. There was a terrible train explosion up in Canada. It incinerated a part of a town, the downtown area of a small Canadian town. It was called the Mont Blanc incident. I have to look it up a bit. You'll know what I'm talking about. If you just look up oil train fire, Canada town destroyed. It'll come up in a second when you see that. We have ways of dealing with nuclear waste. One of the best ways other countries are doing is you take the nuclear waste, you seal it in concrete, and you put it at the bottom of a salt mine. Salt mines, the reason they have so much salt is because there's no groundwater, there's no water that will contaminate it, and the stuff is going to stay down there. Now, the problem with nuclear waste, of course, is that it's still dangerous to humans for thousands of years. We have to store it underground in a place where earthquakes won't get to it, where other people won't get to it, and it won't hurt human beings. But it's still dangerous for tens of thousands of years. Let's say 10,000 years. We have to protect it. Here comes the problem. Let's say you bury this stuff. What happens if, the human race goes extinct? Now, I don't think it's going to go extinct because I think Jesus is going to come back before that happens. But let's say, within a Christian worldview, we, 3,000 years from, 2,000 years from now, even 1,000 years from now, the human race continues, but we don't live on Earth anymore. We terraform, we create interstellar travel, we go and colonize new planets, we leave Earth behind. And what if some other future Earthlings return to Earth and it's kind of like a nostalgic playground to go back and visit, and they come across this nuclear waste in 1,000 years, or 2,000 years, 5,000 years, humans might be speaking an entirely different language, have an entirely different culture. They may not understand the warnings that we leave behind. So one problem that philologists and other people have been trying to, people who study language, overcome is how do you communicate a warning to people thousands of years from now who may have an entirely different language and culture? To give you an example, what does a pirate flag look like? It looks like a skull and crossbones, right? Or a skull and swords. Now, today, we associate that with fun, dressing up like a pirate for Halloween or Pirates of the Caribbean, and it's just kind of a fun thing, the Jolly Roger. But 300 years ago, seeing the Jolly Roger would have instilled the same fear in you as seeing the Al-Qaeda flag would instill fear with you. That today, if you see someone with a Jolly Roger flag, you think they just have an eccentric sense of humor. If you see someone with an Al-Qaeda flag coming at you, you're going to be shaking in your boots. 300 years ago, the Jolly Roger flag was the Al-Qaeda flag. But notice how its meaning changes in just 300 years. Whereas the Jolly Roger was a sign, it was a sign of warning. It was also adapted to warn about plague. It was a solemn warning 300 years ago. Now it's a fun symbol. So if you saw the Jolly Roger on something, you might think, oh, it must be fun pirate stuff, and you open it up. Oh no, the plague was in there. So we have to have some kind of a symbol that can withstand for thousands of years to warn people about our buried nuclear waste. I'm sorry to say this, even if we bury nuclear waste and people get killed 5,000 years from now, that is still the safest thing we can do. A few people get killed who discover it. Than using other forms of energy. Even ones that seem safe, like hydropower. One of the worst industrial accidents in the history of the world happened in China in 1975. It was the Bankou Dam flood. Bankou Dam failed, and this was not just a natural disaster. The Chinese Maoist Communist Party built the dam to substandard safety conditions. Chen Ping, who was one of the safety advisors, told them the dam is unsafe. He was eventually removed from the project and silenced. And then in 1975, after heavy rains, the dam did not have enough sluice gates, which are the little gates that let out excess water. And so the dam failed. And it unleashed a wall of water 10 to 23 feet high that was 6 miles wide. It wiped towns off the face of the map. It's been estimated that, tens of thousands of people were killed in the initial flood, and somewhere around 170,000 people died from epidemics and famine that resulted afterwards. So I would much rather have had a nuclear power plant running instead of having to rely on something like that. So the fact of the matter is that there's always going to be risks in any form of power you use, but you just have to pick the ones that's the least risky. And I think the evidence shows that nuclear is that case. But we can come up with warnings. A lot of people have said we should just bury it in a place with universal warning signs, like jagged, spiky rocks. Like that kind of just is like a universal sign of danger. Stay away from here. In places where nuclear waste is buried, it's been proposed to, they've put plaques in every language on Earth saying this is a place of danger, of invisible threat that will harm, written in all kinds of different languages, even little comics that show someone looking at the radioactive material and keeling over and then dying. My favorite are the out there solutions. This is from mentalfloss.com, a lot of great miscellaneous articles you can read there. And they talk about the more out-of-the-box solutions people have come up to warn others about, to warn people 5,000, 10,000 years from now about buried nuclear waste. Here's a few. One expert proposed writing a message on an artificial moon and launching it into space because the moon would be always visible in the night sky. Another expert said that we should create an atomic priesthood, an elite class of people who would protect the area from one generation to the next by scaring the public with veiled threats of a supernatural curse. It's kind of like in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the people who defend the Grail, they have this kind of enduring priesthood or servants that, that guard the Grail with their lives. I guess that's what they're thinking of. But the strangest suggestion came from two German linguists. They argued that governments around the world, This was a real solution that was offered for the nuclear waste problem. They argued that governments around the world should breed cats that turn colors when exposed to radiation. These so-called ray cats could then be immortalized in song and legend, so that even after the scientific knowledge of radiation had been lost to the sands of time, folklore would tell of their supernatural power to change their fur in the presence of extreme danger. So the idea here is we create a mythological kind of pseudo-religion about cats that change color and radiation. That way, 5,000 years from now, even if in the apocalypse people don't know what radiation is, they know don't go somewhere where the cat changes their color. You got to give them points for originality, at least on that one, if not for, for practicality. So I want to close with, we've shown nuclear power is safe compared to other kinds of power. The nuclear waste problem can be overcome. It is not an insolvable problem. And then the last one is that, well, what if people use nuclear waste to create nuclear weapons? I'm going to let Michael Schellenberger answer this, and I like the way he kind of wraps up his TED Talk on the subject, so I'm going to play that for you.
Well, what about the weapons? Maybe the most surprising thing is that we can't find any examples of countries that have nuclear power and then, oh, decide to go get a weapon. In fact, it works the opposite. What we find is that the only way we know how to get rid of large numbers of nuclear weapons is by using the plutonium in the warheads as fuel in our nuclear power plants. And so if you are wanting to get the world rid of nuclear weapons, then we're going to need a lot more nuclear power. As I was leaving China, the engineer that brought Bill Gates there kind of pulled me aside and he said, "You know, Michael, I appreciate your interest in all the different nuclear supply technologies, but there's this more basic issue, which is that there's just not enough global demand. I mean, we can crank out these machines on assembly lines. We do know how to make things cheap, but there's just not enough people that want them. And so let's do solar and wind and efficiency and conservation. Let's accelerate the advanced nuclear programs. I think we should triple the amount of money we're spending on it. But I just think the most important thing, if we're going to overcome the climate crisis, is to keep in mind that the cause of the clean energy crisis isn't from within our machines. It's from within ourselves."
I hope that is a good lesson to remember. And just another point I thought I would put out there, especially we as Catholics, we are called to be good stewards of the earth, which means we should use our minds to make a world where human beings can flourish, where people can live in dignity, and where they can have a clean planet that can be given to their descendants. There's the old saying, we don't inherit the land from our ancestors, rather we have it on loan to later give to our children. It's loaned to us from our children. Thank you all so much for being with me this week, this Free for All Friday. I hope you all enjoy your weekend. And the links I talked about here in the podcast, I will include in the show notes at trendhornpodcast.com. You all have been great, and I hope you have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.